Hello, everyone. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, on the left side of the Great Divide, balancing into another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler, and this is the Mountain Madrigals with The Road Home, recorded at a rehearsal in 2014. The Mountain Madrigals continue their holiday concerts with two shows this weekend. The first is tonight at the First United Methodist Church in Glenwood Springs at 7:30. And another show follows this Sunday at 7:30, also at the Methodist Church. The concerts are free, donations are accepted, and child care is provided. Also, I should mention that there's another nice holiday show happening tonight in Glenwood Springs, the Aspen Choral Society performing Handel's Messiah at St. Stephen's Catholic Church in Glenwood Springs tonight at 7 p.m. Well, for several years now, Aspen's Hudson Reed Ensemble has brought a classic Christmas story to life as a radio play and performed it around the valley. This year, It's a Wonderful Life, the classic Frank Capra film starring Jimmy Stewart that has been adapted as a radio play, and I spoke with Kent last Tuesday about this year's version of It's a Wonderful Life. Welcome, Kent Reed.
Hi, how are you, Luke?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Happy holidays.
Thanks so much.
Hey. Thank you. Teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings.
Well, that's what's happening. It's a Wonderful Life, anyway. Clarence, and It's a Wonderful Life finally gets its wings after he gets George Bailey squared away.
After he gets him squared away, right. He shows him what's what, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean... what's really important and valuable in life, and it's easy to forget that. And so this whole play is about remembering that although things aren't so great, they could be a lot worse than they are. Mm-hmm. And it's a play about hope, actually. Yeah.
Well, isn't
and
it
redemption?
Is hope and redemption, and what better things to celebrate on the holidays?
Yeah. it's a sweet play, and the way we're doing it, it's we have about 10 actors, something like that. And, of course, we are we're recording it for rebroadcast later in December on the radio, and so it'll be recorded in front of a live audience, which is fun. And what else can I tell you about it? Of course, it's December, opens December 9th, Friday, and plays December 10th, Saturday, at the Aspen Community Church at 7 o'clock. And then we move down to the Basalt Library on Sunday, December 11th, and that performance is at 5:30 p.m.
I discovered, Kent, that this year marks the 70th anniversary of It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, that's great. That's great, Luke. You know more about its history than I do. Yeah, I didn't know that it was the 70th anniversary. Yeah.
And it wasn't until the 70s that most Americans became aware of the movie because the copyright fell into the public domain at that point. And, of course, that's when TV jumped all over it and shows it a million times every Christmas season.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, there are several radio scripts out there for that very reason because the rights had lapsed for that movie. And so... ours, of course, that has a whole bunch of sound effects, and we've even got a couple of musical jingles in there. I can't remember who the production company was, RKO or whoever, but yeah, that was a major... you don't see that happen very often with the big boys when something like that falls through the cracks.
Yeah, how about that? Well, I guess that maybe that was the work of Clarence somewhere up there.
Well, yeah, you might have heard the bell tinkle. I don't know.
Well, I was going to ask you about the sound effects, because a radio play, that basically means sound effects. So are all of you participating in that, or is there one person that's designated the sound effects guy? How does that work?
Well, here's the deal. A folio artist, which is what that is called, the sound effects guy, who does it live, which they had all the time in radio doing horse clops and all that. But that's an art. It is really, really an intense field of study of how to come up with all these various sounds and have a microphone adjacent to it. And so it sounds like, water rushing or cab horn or whatever. In lieu of that, because we haven't found anybody in the valley, I'd love to find somebody that can do that, but we haven't yet. So we garnered a bunch of sound effects off the internet, which we electronically, play over the speakers, whether it's, wind or a baby crying or a car horn or a cat taking off from the curb or splashes in the water, whatever. I mean, I think there are probably, I'd say, close to 40 sound effects of those, of that kind, environmental sound effects, that we use for this. And basically, it's... we've got Ben Diamond, who is a sound engineer, has loaded them into a computer, and so we, when the cue comes up, we just press a button and there's the sound effect. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Now walk me through what the audience will see. It's not a full-blown theatrical production. Are you the actors sitting in a row in front of microphones and performing it that way?
That's actually what it is. We've set it up kind of as a radio studio. We have a applause sign and an on-the-air sign. And the actors, the community church is a great venue for this type of thing, because it's really kind of like the Grand Ole Opry. In fact, the Grand Ole Opry was out of a church, much like the community church, with a balcony and this wonderful stained glass and seating and all that. So the actors are where the minister would usually be, up on the platform there. They'll be sitting in chairs. We have two microphones, the kind of 40s era microphones, actually. And so as the actors, whatever scene they're in, will get up and come up to the microphone and read off the radio script. And so that's how it works. It's not a play, really. It's just a radio program, basically. And they used to do that a lot, around the country, in Chicago, Kansas City, New York, whatever. Jack Benny Show or whatever. Performed in front of a live, a live audience, and often broadcast live, and also brought, recorded for later broadcasts. But that's the idea we have here. It's kind of a throwback to the 40s, where you'd have a live audience for a radio production, and then it would be broadcast over the airwaves. So that's what we're trying to replicate.
Now, are you giving yourselves the luxury of take two or take three, or are you going all the way through? Is the pressure on?
Well, it is live in that way. I mean, you're live in front of an audience, yeah. So there is no take one, two, or three. It's not like film or even a something you could edit. I mean, we're going to do, I think, three different performances of this, two in Aspen, one in Basalt. And for the radio part of it, we probably will edit those three tapes together that we've recorded.
Gotcha.
And come out with the one we like best. But all three of them will be in front of a live audience. So if you make a snafu, then there you have it.
There it goes. Well, you're not... You haven't, the actors haven't memorized the lines. You've got the scripts in front of you, I'm presuming.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, just like, Orson Welles used to do in the old days.
Yeah.
Everybody has a script, and they'll be reading from those.
Well, it's throwback all the way, and so I guess it's very appropriate that you're choosing It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
Talk about the cast. Who's playing what?
Well, you know, frankly, Luke, if I start getting in all that, I'll come up with about six names and forget six others.
Okay.
They wouldn't be happy about it.
Okay.
But all I, you know, I can say in a general term, general terms that the first, we first did It's a Wonderful Life. Oh, I don't know. It was, I think, in 2014. And after that, we did It's a Christmas Carol 2015 last year. When we did it in 2014, we have some of the same cast members that were a part of that cast. And then in this 2016 version of It's a Wonderful Life, we have several new people. I can tell you that the two principals, George Bailey, who was played by Todd Hartley last year, is going to be played by Travis McDivitt this year. And the role of Mary, that was played by Kathy Pulaski in 2014, this year is being played by someone that's kind of new on the theatrical scene, Brittany Bays. So I can remember those two names.
That's
so
funny.
At least I got two in there. Yeah.
And, well, it's funny. I read that George Bailey was voted the number 9 hero in 100 years of film. Film hero. And Henry Potter, the villain, he was the number 6 villain of 100 years of film history. So that's a legacy.
God.
That's a legacy.
Boy, look, you know, that's what I really appreciate you, about your interviews. You do your homework. I'm saying.
Well,
boy.
You know, I learned how to read Wikipedia, so, you know, the secret of that.
Well, that's always a good idea.
How does an actor approach this in terms of emoting or not emoting through the voice only? Does the actor have to approach it differently?
Yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, it really is, because these 10 folks, they play, some of them play 2, some of them play 3, some of them play 4 different characters.
Wow.
And, the pitch of your voice, some of these people were going to, you know, for instance, probably have a Cockney accent, probably going to have an Italian accent for various different characters. Because in those days, I mean, the neighborhoods definitely were a melting pot. You know, you had a lot of Europeans. So anyway, that's one way to do it. And just sheer force of personality, how the speed that a person speaks at, the intensity that a person speaks at. For the live audience, we're going to, you know, switch out maybe a hat or a scarf or this or that, you know, just to kind of give them a visual cue. But yeah, for radio, you've got to, and that's our mission, is to make a distinctive character, even though you're playing 4 different ones. Age also. We have a couple of kids in this production that are actually going to be played by adults. And so, you know, to raise the pitch of your voice and this and that, and the excitement of a kid. And then, of course, we have older people. And, in fact, we have some women playing male roles. So it's a lot of fun, and hopefully a lot of fun for the audience. To hear these folks, how they differentiate these characters.
Well, 3 chances this weekend, Friday and Saturday at the Community Church in Aspen at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 5:30 at the Basalt Library.
That's correct. Yep.
Kent Reed, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're so welcome, Luke. You know, happy holidays to you, and thanks for the interview. It's great. Always is.
You bet. Let's do it again.
Okay, man. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's a Christmas present from a very dear friend of mine. like his wings.
That's right. That's right. Attaboy, Clarence.
Thunder River Theater brings a poignant piece of theater to the stage tonight. It's The Last Romance, and it was written by Joe DiPietro in 2011. It's a Golden Years romance written with a lot of humor and affection for its characters. I caught up with Mike Monroney by telephone last Tuesday, and we were joined in the studio by two of the stars of the show, Chip Wynn Wells and Wendy Perkins. Are you expecting to find a lost romance at the Hotel Jerome?
Yeah, how about any romance? Hopefully it's not the last romance.
Oh, I know that feeling too, but we won't go there, right?
No, we won't.
Well, you are gathered here, Mike, along with Wendy Perkins. Hi, Wendy.
Hello. Hi, Luke.
Hi, Wendy.
Glad to have
hey,
you
Mike.
Here. And also Chip Wynn Wells is here.
Hello,
great,
both
hi,
of you.
And Mike Monroney, the director of The Lost Romance, which has its opening this weekend at Thunder River Theater. Thanks for joining me, all.
You bet. Thank you for having us. And
yep.
It's a very exciting time for us this week.
Mm-hmm. Mike, definitely.
Mike,
and Luke, you're saying The Last Romance, right?
I did say that, didn't I?
It sounded like The Lost.
Oh, okay. The Last.
It's not Lost. It's Last.
That's a crucial distinction, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I think it, well, we won't go there.
We won't go there.
Because we don't want to spoil it, do we?
No. Nope.
Mike, maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about the story. What is the last
See?
The last romance about? Tell me.
Well, it's a terrific little play by Joe DiPietro that tells the story of three, and dare I call them senior citizens.
You dare? Dare.
There's a...
Go for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, is that okay? I mean, I can use that, right?
Sure.
Wendy?
Well, we are.
Yeah.
I'm and, proud of it.
They live across the river from Manhattan in New Jersey. And the gentleman who is sort of the focal point of the play, Ralph Bellini, is out for a walk one day and in just a pure turn of chance goes a different route and ends up in a little dog park and sees a woman with a little chihuahua, and something clicks for him. And he sort of comes the next day hoping to engineer a chance to meet her, and does. Meanwhile, back at home, his sister, who's been taking care of him for the last 12 years since his wife died, is wondering where he's gone and, you know, suspects he's missing, and finds out from a friend that he's walked into this park. So the three of their lives intersect for the first time, and relationships between the three become, you know, developed and intersect and sort of intertwine, and that's the basis of the story of the show.
Hmm. And that man is Ralph.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And that Ralph in this play is played by Willie Moseley, is that correct?
Also correct.
True.
Willie, mm-hmm. We love you, Willie. I was just telling the ladies that I knew Willie back in the day, way back when we first hit Aspen, and I was hoping he would be here. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
And back way back in the day, Willie and I worked together at the Crystal Palace. So I've known Willie since the very early 80s, and Mike as well.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So you guys sort of know each other's tendencies on the stage.
Yes.
Huh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that helpful?
Yeah, I think this is the fourth play that I've directed that Willie was in.
Oh.
And I've been in plays with Wendy, but it's my first experience working with Chip.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Huh.
I've worked with both Willie and Wendy before, but not with Mike.
How about that? Huh. So, Wendy, eventually you fall in love with Ralph. Is that right?
Eventually, I do.
But it takes a while.
It's hard to believe as that is, yes.
Yes. It's not hard to believe. Ralph is adorable.
No, he's adorable.
It's the theme of the play is really that, you know, people do, they fall in love and something gets in the way, basically. And the older you get and the more baggage you have, the more likely something is going to get in the way.
And also that how far are people willing to go to not be alone? And how important is that fear of being alone?
So do the characters discover that they can drop all that baggage, Wendy?
Well, I don't want to be a spoiler here. So okay. I'm not going to tell you.
Okay.
Nor I.
Yes and no.
Now, Chip, you mm-hmm. play Rose, who is Ralph's sister.
Correct.
Are you one of the impediments to this romance?
I don't think so.
No?
No. not at all.
It would appear so at the beginning of the play.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So there's an arc there.
There mm-hmm. is an arc there. And there are discoveries in the second act somewhere towards the end of the play.
You mean there's skeletons in the closet?
Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huh. And I also think that there's a term out there called an interrupting angel. And I think that in some ways, something that appears at first to be an impediment is actually an interrupting angel that causes you to change your course of action. And I think all of us, Ralph and Carol and Rose, all have their chance to be an interrupting angel.
Huh. Good point.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Huh. I like that.
Does everybody else accept that, though?
In time, I think so.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, with any relationship there, you know, I have never been in any relationship that has just been off at the start smooth and perfect. I think there are bumps and lumps and, you know, discoveries about each other and, you know, what do we have at stake in creating this relationship? And, you know, where are the impediments? How do we get past them? And how important is it to get past them? You know, both in my relationship with Ralph and my relationship with Rose.
Mm-hmm.
There are, you know, consequences in this play for every possible outcome. And obviously we're not going to tell you what the actual outcome of the play is, but you know, if one relationship is successful, it's possible that it's at the detriment of another. It's possible that, you know, the success of love in one place might be, you know, the ruin of love in another. So it's in some ways it's sort of an unlikely and out of the norm triangle. You know, normally a love triangle is between one person who's in love with two others purely in a romantic way. And this is a triangle between a brother and a sister and another woman who enters their lives. And it's different, but every bit is valid in terms of looking at the way, you know, human emotions play out.
Well, go ahead, Wendy.
I play Carol, who's the love interest of Ralph. And I work with older people. I work with the elderly. And what I find in all three of these characters is kind of more of a desperation because we're running out of time. So there's a desperation in kind of keeping the status quo for Rose, certainly, and a desperation in, is there anything else in this life, or do I have to resolve myself to accepting the status quo for both Ralph and Carol?
So you're not talking a desperation of mortality, but a desperation
Well, there's a desperation of mortality. That's always hanging over.
Okay. Huh.
You know, when people get in the people in this play are in their late 70s, beginning 80.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
So there's that, but it's also the idea that you're running out of time to create or maintain a human connection.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because your peer group is slowly dying away.
Right.
Right. It's interesting because, you know, we're used to teenagers falling in love at the drop of a hat, and that those relationships don't always necessarily last. And I think we always tend as, you know, parents and friends and advisors, you know, for people to take your time, wait and see how this works out. Don't go jumping into anything. But it's interesting that the arc takes us from the immediacy of that teenage love into our, you know, the winter of our lives. And yeah, we sort of need to make things happen really, really fast if there's going to be a chance of any success and any, you know, fruition of those relationships.
Plus, I don't think that there's any age to responding to the hormones that are reactivated, no matter how old you are. If you find something that feels good, it feels good, and you would like for it to keep
develop.
On. Yeah, and continue.
One of my favorite lines in the play is when Ralph describes how being touched by Rose makes him feel.
No,
I mean,
Carol.
By Carol, yeah.
This play is not about incest.
No.
Absolutely not.
No.
Well, I would think there's a danger in overly sentimentalizing mature love, let's call it. You know, that golden gauzy on golden pond kind of thing.
Yeah.
Were you aware of that as you were working this?
Well, I actually, at Thunder River, I played Ethel on Golden Pond. And in this play, there is lots of humor. There's humor in the characters. There's humor in the writing. It's really a well-written, lovely play, as there was in Golden Pond. Mm-hmm. There is sentimentality. I think the audience will go away with a real feeling of being touched and, you know, crying and laughing and, you know.
I guess what I was referring to was that there might be a danger of, I don't know what, being a little condescending, like, oh, look at the old folks. They're they're falling in love.
No.
No?
Not yeah. Really.
If you come away with that, we haven't done our job.
Okay.
Huh. Right. I think we approach these people, you know, trying to make them as real as possible. And when you do that and you make, and first off, it's extremely well written. And I feel like the playwright really understands these people and the, you know, the age group that he's portraying. But if you come at it from a position of honesty and trusting the script and creating those relationships, then it's real. It's not, I think it's not painted with a brush that's, as you would have put it, too gauzy or too sentimental.
Hmm. Well, I guess like anything else, humor is a saving grace as far as that goes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Huh. It certainly has to be.
Yeah. I understand opera plays a part in this. Tell me.
Well, there's a fourth character in the play. We've talked about three, the brother and sister and the new love interest, Carol. But there's a fourth character who doesn't actually really exist. He only appears in Ralph's memory, but it's a version of his younger self. And in his youth, he actually auditioned for the Metropolitan Opera. And he's of Italian heritage. He loves Italian opera. And so this fourth character, who we call Raphael, comes into play and comments on the action in Italian and sings some classic Italian opera as the show goes along.
And there is actually a character and a man named Chris Caschetta, who is
right.
an opera singer.
Thank you.
Who he's
Thank
a real person
yeah.
mm-hmm. who does come and sing. He's not just in Ralph's imagination.
Real. Yeah, the actor's real, yeah. but the character is. We get to see him, but the other people in the play don't.
So mm-hmm. you say that that person provides a little commentary, kind of like a Greek chorus.
Certainly a good analogy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Definitely.
One of the lines I came across, which I didn't read the script, but I read, you know, several commentaries on the play, something about in opera, life is big.
Mm-hmm.
Everything
yeah.
is big. You walk through the door and you sing an aria and it's big.
Yeah. And Carol responds to that by saying, life should be like that.
Do you think only older people think that?
Probably not.
No.
No, of course not.
No. Yeah. But I think people
that don't think that way never get to be old. They just just kind of stay
wither
the same
away.
And they wither. Yeah. Well, I really feel that way.
And I do think as people get older, generally their vision becomes more contained and their lives are not as full because they can't do as much and they don't do as much and they're not working and they're not raising a family and, you know, often they're away from their children as Carol is. So, yeah, I mean, their lives really take a turn at that late 70, 80-year-old stage.
So it's notable that in that stage of life, both characters believe that life can be big and you can sing an aria. Still.
Well, it's amazing what love can do. Mm-hmm. It makes everything you feel young and you feel big and you feel
powerful.
Powerful. Uh-huh. You don't feel like you're an 80-year-old decrepit person. You know, your youth returns.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Right.
And I find that in the character of Carol.
And you must see it in your work.
Mm-hmm.
As well.
Huh. Would a younger person profit from seeing this show?
Oh, yes.
Certainly they'll be entertained. I have no doubt of that.
Yep.
Yeah, no question.
Yep. And we can't leave today without saying something about Peaches.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. Another character. Go ahead. No, I'll let you. Since you get to interact with the dog, I'll let you explain it. But there are many dogs who are part of the play, but one in particular.
Because most of the play takes place in the dog park, the dog run, and Carol's initial love interest is a little Chihuahua named Peaches, who comes from the care center in Carbondale, and she's a rescue dog, and Carol talks to Peaches, but the audience doesn't get to see Peaches right away.
Oh.
And I'm not going to give that spoiler.
<Good. laughs>
But
okay.
Even though I just did.
So we
did get an adorable little dog that does appear in the second act.
Well, what happens if the dog barks in the wrong place?
I don't know that there is a wrong place, quite frankly.
Nope. We're actors. We can deal with anything.
So there's a little bit of improv attitude there.
Certainly.
There has to be in every theatrical endeavor. There has to be improv.
Exactly.
Because you never know what's going to come out of somebody else's mouth.
That's right. That's right.
You mean the incorrect line at the wrong time or something?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, could be.
Oh, okay. Well, Chip, we haven't heard a lot from you. Tell me about your character, Rose. You're the sister of Ralph, and you're a little bit of a metal, aren't you?
I think that Rose is a human being trying to meet her basic human needs. And she's limited in what she has available to her because her whole role in life has been dependent upon the way other people define her. And so I think she does an amazing job with what little she has. And I like Rose. I really do like her.
Because, I like her too.
Because she's got spunk and she has compassion. And she, even though she fights it, she's not too old to learn. And I like that about her and I respect that.
Well, like I said, I didn't read the script, but just what little I read, she didn't come across as a particularly sympathetic character. So I guess something happens in the script that I'm not aware of.
Well, yeah. An actor got a hold of it. Uh-huh.
And the thing with all of these characters, and, you know, due not only to the talent of the playwright, but the talent of the actors themselves, is they all undergo some metamorphosis over the course of the play. I think, you know, any good work, you see people change and see them learn, and there's no question that that happens in this play.
Let's talk a little bit about the sets.
The set is, as we said, it all takes place in the dog park. So we've got sidewalks, we've got a bench, we've got a tree. You can see the New York City skyline in the distance. And then right in the middle of the park, at least in the physical reality, we actually see the apartment where Rose and Ralph live, or the house. So there's a very sort of, metamorphosis in the set itself from one location to the other. They almost exist within each other and sort of represent, you know, Ralph being pulled away from the home that he shares by what happens in the park, and you know, Rose's bastion is where she lives. So I think it's a very interesting set. Everything just sort of flows. There's a spot up actually in the audience where our opera singer performs most of his work, you know, representing once again that special place in Ralph's memory. And so everything sort of just flows together and exists side by side. We actually have the younger Ralph assisting with some of the set changes. So even though the other characters don't actually see him, they are affected by what he does.
And then also the upstage railing, I think, is so cool because it goes from really slats in a fence, and then it starts just changing, and it becomes wainscoting in an apartment. It's very cool.
It is.
Love that.
Sean did an amazing, amazing job.
Sean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sean.
He's
Jeffries.
Jeffries.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And he is the set director and lighting and sound at Thunder River.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's remarkable.
He's the technical director, yes.
And the costumes? I understand that Ralph is sort of a working man. He was through his life, whereas Carol maybe was a little bit upper class.
Yes, she was.
Is that right?
Yep, she was. She was an executive secretary,
so
which you know, in that age was quite a feat. To be an executive, you know, it was quite, she wasn't a teacher or a nurse.
Uh-huh.
She was an executive secretary. So she's very well put together, which was not easy for me to put those costumes together because I live in Aspen, you know.
We were talking about that before the interview. They dressed differently back east.
Yeah. Yeah, they did.
And Rose clearly is wearing a dress that her mother wore.
Okay.
And, because why not? It's still good, and it served her mother. It's going to serve her in much the same way.
Huh. I want to say one more thing about the set and, you know, where we're playing, where the play takes place. It creates, you know, the whole atmosphere creates a real intimacy, knowing the characters. The audience is really, you know, not part of the set, so don't be afraid out there. You're not going to be part of the play, but we are playing, you know, right up to 4 feet of the audience on three different sides. So it's a three-quarters side.
Huh.
Yeah.
You know, Mike, what's the decision-making process on things like that? I guess that's your purview.
The decision-making process in terms of choosing the play or once the play?
No, the staging, Wendy was just describing.
With a small cast like this, it's really easy to collaborate as a group and sort of determine, you know, sort of let the blocking happen out of the lines. And then once you have a basic framework, you know, then I can sort of begin to, you know, inject my, you know, theatrical personality on, tweaking, you know, maybe this person should stand here and maybe it helps, you know, the humor if a certain person is there and reacts to a line in a certain way, because we always think that a line is funny, but honestly in theater and even in movies and television, it's how the characters around that person react to that line that often create the humor.
Hmm.
So this the way the audience and the stage are set up in this show creates some interesting blocking challenges because of sight lines and the fact that the audience stretches around three sides of the stage, and the certain angles you almost have to block it as if the play is in the round so that every side of the audience gets something to watch at all times. So that's fun. That's actually really fun to sort of, you know, I try and sit in a different place in the audience every night when I'm directing, so I get an idea of what different parts of the audience are experiencing.
It's interesting that you talk about essentially what you're saying when you're talking about how the impact of the humor comes from the way characters react to each other.
Exactly.
That implies to me a radical trust in your actors.
No question, yeah.
Well,
and
I
in
hope
each other.
So.
They have to trust each other, yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. They have to really listen and really trust each other. And it's interesting, you know, there's you want everything to be natural, but there is a technical side to acting on the stage, and you know, you have to allow that the audience is part of that collaboration as well. You have to sort of learn how the audience laughs and not say a line while they're laughing so they lose something. And you actually sort of, in the early part of a play, train the audience how to react to what you're presenting.
And all of us actors in this play have been around on the stage for a long, long time. So we're
true.
Used to, you know, responding to the audience and being in the present moment. What the beauty of theater is, it's present moment. And if you're somewhere else, you're going to screw up, and you're going to screw up your fellow actors. So really, to stay right there with each other is so important, and that's really part of the, you know, the joy of doing theater.
Because when you're rehearsing, it's kind of linear, and then when the audience shows up, suddenly you're in this amazingly firm base of support because you're in a triangular arrangement. And boy, oh boy, does that enrich things. It really fleshes it out. It does.
Interesting. Well, The Last Romance opening this weekend. Opening night is Friday, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's correct.
And then it runs two more weekends after that.
Yep. Which
correct.
Is all, it's all...
With our final performance, at least in Carbondale, being actually on Christmas Eve, a matinee. So if people have family visiting from out of town and are looking for something to do over the holidays, it's sort of a nice way to kick off the holidays with your family.
And then the show moves to Snowmass Chapel in January for two weekends.
Oh, that's kind of a different thing, isn't it?
At the end of January.
Right.
Huh.
Yep.
Is that an effort to, broaden your base a little bit? Is that...
It's a collaboration that works both for us and for the Snowmass Chapel. They've often produced theatrical events in the chapel there. Their schedule didn't allow for them to take that on this year. So it was, I don't remember which way it went, if they asked us or if we asked them, but we're always looking, you know, to be accessible. Often people in Aspen or Snowmass, believe it or not, aren't willing to drive past the Intercept lot to go to Carbondale to see something or to Glenwood to see something. It's the first time we've tried it. I think it's a good chance for us to see what sharing this show with a different part of the valley can offer to everybody.
And in a very different space.
Yep.
Very different.
Chip and I actually were in Calendar Girls a year and a half ago together at the Snowmass Chapel. So we are familiar with the stage and its differences.
Limitations.
I was going to say that, but I thought it'd be nice.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you deal with what you have, right?
Yeah.
Well, Mike Monroney, I want to thank you for joining us by telephone, the director of The Last Romance. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Luke. I really appreciate it. Thanks, ladies, for being here as well.
Yep. Thank you, Mikey.
Well, thank you.
Yes. Thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Wendy Perkins, and thank you, Chip Wynn Wells. You can get
thank
tickets.
You so much.
Yes, thank you, Luke.
You can get tickets and information at ThunderRiverTheater.com. Stay with us. More to come on today's Express Yourself. Mm-hmm.
no place to go. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Let it snow, let it snow. Well, last year, Colorado lost 1,058 people to suicide. That's a pretty shocking number when you think about it. Pickens and Garfield counties are among the highest percentage rates in Colorado. There are, however, people and organizations in the Valley who are working to bring those numbers down. And one of those is here with me now on Express Yourself, Matt Hazlett. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. Why do you think those numbers are so high, Matt?
Well, from the research that I've done and that other researchers have contributed on a broad scale, they typically come to three different conclusions. One conclusion is that people who move out here and who live out here really have what they're calling a frontier mentality. They want to come out here to explore the rugged outdoors and just sort of have that pioneering attitude of going out and having as much adventure as they can. And so what you get with that is a lot of strong personalities who are going to be more stubborn when it comes to asking for help than others. So that would be one thing. Another one, which I think I've seen particularly here in Carbondale, is that there are some towns out here that are really transient in nature, especially among the younger people between 20 and 35. That a lot of people move here and they leave families behind. So there isn't a built-in support network of the family structure. People come out here and tend to create their own chosen family, right? They choose their group of friends. And so you can leave behind whatever you want. And so if an old issue from the past that's been plaguing you since childhood that your family might be more intimately acquainted with, it's easier for you not to deal with it. And those that you've surrounded yourself with aren't going to be as attuned to picking up on some of those signs that you might be in trouble. And then the other one that you and I were talking about earlier is that people are really out here to have fun. It's an outdoor lifestyle. They come out here for skiing. They come out here for mountain biking. They come out here for whitewater rafting. And so that raises two problems. Number one, if someone's really having a hard time with a mental health issue, those that are here to have fun when work is over and when the right season hits for their chosen activity, they want to soak that up as much as they can. And so they won't necessarily be as attuned to those who are struggling. They're going to be attuned to the fun that they want to have and to what they want to do. And also, a lot of these activities require a significant chunk of change. Mountain biking is expensive. Skiing is expensive. Whitewater rafting is expensive. Just the lifestyle in Aspen and Carbondale alone is expensive. And so I think a lot of people see those that are able to take advantage of those activities and they feel like they can't be part of the group because they don't have the money to keep up.
Well, there have been suicides and near suicides lately in the Roaring Fork Valley. And so you've decided to do something about it. You're putting together an event. Tell me about it.
Well, so it was a couple things. We had, the most significant thing, and I'll sort of keep the details foggy just to respect the family, but we had a recent teenage suicide in one of our schools here in the school district, and the student knew a lot of my students. I teach part-time music programs at Carbondale Community School, so I work with elementary and junior high. And a lot of my students knew him, and if you were in the teacher loop, I think you were affected by it. And I had also just partnered with a charity foundation called Movember. Movember stands for Mustaches in November. It's a large international charity. I think it actually started in Australia, where basically for the month of November, you can partner with them. You can set up a fundraising page and you raise awareness for men's health in one of three categories. They do testicular cancer, prostate cancer, and mental health. So all the guys that are partnered with them grow mustaches for November. And use the mustache as a conversation starter. I chose mental health because that's one that I'm more acquainted with and more, intimately involved with. And so naturally I'm a lot more passionate about it. And I decided to get the word out. So we're putting on an event. It is at Carbondale Community College or Colorado Mountain College at the Lapala Center at 5:30 on Sunday, December 11th, this Sunday.
And you have some speakers lined up and organizations too?
Yep. So I'm going to be speaking. I'll be talking a little bit about the Movember charity, and I'll be talking about some of the resources that we have available here in the Valley for people who are struggling with those things. We want to give people tangible and intangible resources. Tangible being, you know, the information and marketing material that some of these nonprofits have contributed to us in doing this event. And intangible meaning we want people to feel empowered, like they know who they can talk to, like they have a strong community, like there are people out there who really do want to help. I know tons of teachers who, you know, the main reason that they teach and the main purpose that they find in teaching isn't so much in the subject matter that they teach, but in that they get to mentor young minds and who are willing to be involved if they detect signs of psychological unrest. So we just want people to know how many people are out there and who are available to them.
Well, there are lots of great resources in this valley. I know that the Aspen Hope Center is one that comes to mind. And let's see, they have a great website, aspenhope.org. And aren't they the ones that provide the hope line, the hotline, suicide hotline?
Yeah, there's a couple of them that do. Aspen Hope, theirs really popped out at me. I guess I'll just give the phone number real quick. It's 970-925-5858. And it's just, it's an indispensable resource in that it's 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. And for every hour of the day and every day of the week, you have a licensed professional clinician. So if you call them during business hours, you'll get an office coordinator who will just take a brief synopsis of what you're calling about, and they'll attach you to the appropriate health professional. And if you call after business hours, they have their health professionals and clinicians on staff all night who will just answer the phone directly. And so it's different than, say, you know, a national suicide prevention hotline where you might just get a volunteer on the phone. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you get a licensed professional.
Is it just a matter of friends and family being ultra attentive to everybody around them? Or is it deeper than that?
Well,
as far as preventing suicide.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly part of it, being deeply attentive. But I think it's going to be very difficult, I think, as a parent to notice that your teen is really having a hard time, because who doesn't know a mopey teenager? You know, and I think teenagers who are depressed or emotional can appear to be quite normal in their depression or in their emotional states, because that's part of being a teenager. So I think what we want to do is educate people. We want you to be attuned and we want you to be aware, but we also want you to know exactly what to be aware of. And I think we have, other than me, we have two other speakers at the event who are professional, who are working in the field, and who might really be able to elucidate some of those signs for you, for parents, for friends, for whomever.
Tell me about them in the short 2 minutes we have left, Matt.
Okay. Well, we have Craig Farnham, who is a guidance counselor at CMC. He's got his PhD in educational psychology. He's also just a good guy. He's my landlord. And so I know his wife and his little daughter very well. And he's going to be talking about what he calls perceptual and statistical data in the Valley, meaning the data that people see versus the data collected that shows what people are actually killing themselves over or getting depressed over. And then we have Stefan Bate, who's executive director of A New Path, which is an organization that takes young men after recovery from substance abuse and helps them set up their lives after post-sobriety. He's hilarious. He's really funny. He's really intelligent, and he's been in the trenches. And so I think he's just an invaluable resource. If we just got a couple of minutes, can I just say which organizations are actually here?
Yes,
and what
please.
They provide? Okay. So we mentioned Aspen Hope. Again, their phone number for the hotline is 970-925-5858. We have Mind Springs, which is a mental health center in Glenwood, right by Thunder River Market. We have Aspen Strong. Their website is aspenstrong.org. And you should go visit them because they provide a free mental health screening on the front page of their website for anybody. So you go on there, you click on an issue that you think you're interested in. You can do it in the privacy of your own home. And once you get your results, it's completely confidential. And if you seem to be at risk for anything, they give you phone numbers and resources that you can call immediately.
What's that website again?
AspenStrong.org.
Okay.
And then lastly, we have the Jay Walker Lodge, which is a young men's recovery facility. And they are obviously intimately acquainted with A New Path, where Stefan Bate works. Jay Walker typically detoxes the client or detoxes the patient. And once they find themselves in sobriety, A New Path helps them get their lives back on track and create a sober identity for themselves moving forward.
You know, when I was coming up, i.e. when I was younger, it was kind of hard to talk about suicide. I don't think that stigma is there much anymore. And I think it's partly because of efforts like yours and this event on Sunday that brings up and in a way that people can talk about it and learn something.
I certainly hope so. It's definitely been my experience that the more open that I've been with friends and with loved ones, and the more I tell stories of hardship in my own life, the easier it gets to tell those stories. I think the more you're willing to talk about it, the easier it becomes for you to process it and to let it go and move on.
So Sunday, CMC Lapla in Carbondale. What time did you say?
5:30.
5:30. And it's free, I'm assuming.
And it's free. Absolutely free. Yep.
All right. Well, come on down and learn something new about an important issue in the Valley.
All right. Thanks, Luke.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.